You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 29th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, N Plus One magazine editor Nikki Saval on Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Also on the program today, hidden tapes of New York Fed so-called regulators with Goldman Sachs shows that they don't exactly hold Goldman Sachs' feet to the fire. Also on the program today, Democrats, should they be worried? Yes. Of an imminent takeover of the Senate. Also in Hong Kong, massive protests, Occupy style. And in Ferguson, cops don't necessarily wear their nameplates, but they do wear bracelets in support of the cop who murdered Michael Brown. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, we also have a wonderful moment from Sarah Palin vowing to take over, not necessarily the White House, but a building down the street from the White House. Here is Sarah Palin speaking at the Values Voters Summit, decrying, of course, the use of the race card and vowing to bring truth to a place where apparently they're going to build a hotel. Let's hear this now.
The lies that they tell about you, calling you the intolerant ones, the haters, the bigots. Oh, and that disgusting charge of being racist. You know, I'm speaking to the most slandered group in America today. Well, join me in telling the lamestream media then that we wear your scorn with pride. The lies that you tell about us, well, you can't defeat our arguments, so all you can do is change the subject. So we win.
Pause. That is a pretty tepid applause. Part of it, people could be just like wondering, what's the argument again? Let's just go back to wearing their scorn and let's serve up something for them to be scornful of.
And pulling that race card, how much longer do you think they're going to do? Oh, it's just... It's not even smart. It's not even smart when one simply wants our government to live within its means and to not tax us to and beyond death, not to mortgage our kids' future, and that being for today's selfish wants. Not because of that, we're racist? Well, what isn't smart is when they try to slap that on Colonel Allen West and Dr. Ben Carson and J.C. Watts and Raphael and Ted Cruz and my husband, Todd Palin. Yeah, no, those truly prejudiced folks, just remember this, that they scream racism our way just to end debate. Well, don't retreat. You reload with truth, which I know is an endangered species at 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue anyway, truth.
Yeah. 1400 Pennsylvania, of course, I think it is. It's a small two-floor building that I think they're getting ready to put up a hotel. The Hotel Lie. No, I don't think so. She just got it wrong. But what do you want, folks? She was winging it. All right, we got to take a break when we come back. Nikhil Saval on Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Nikhil Saval, he's the editor of N Plus One magazine and author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Thanks so much for joining us, Nikhil.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start. I want to get into the history of the workplace, but you had written in the in Cube's introduction that you were inspired by the book White Collar by C. Wright Mills. I'm not terribly familiar with that book, but tell us what it was about that book that led you to write Cubed.
White Collar is sort of a classic of American sociology, and maybe C. Wright Mills is maybe his best book. It's it came out in the 1950s, and you know, at that time, Mills was among the first to observe that white collar workers in the United States were on pace to exceed the number of blue collar workers, and basically make the United States a kind of white collar nation. And so he wanted to examine what it meant for the U.S. And, you know, this was broadly true for other countries and what advanced capitalist countries in the rest of the world, what this meant for its social consequences, cultural consequences, what kind of political formations these white-collar workers would have, you know, and what, you know, what it meant for the United States to have this different kind of middle class, very different from, you know, the heavily industrialized working class of the early 20th century that made up the backbone of the country. And he was pretty scathing. I mean, it was the kind of amazing thing about it was just to look back and just to, especially in a nation that is much more officed, you know, much more characterized by white-collar work, to see how much he thought that this was a group that was largely spineless, that was didn't have any kind of independent political agency, kind of was more likely to follow other people. He pointed out a lot of things about how the nation was becoming more the workplace was more psychologized. White collar work is really heavily dependent on how you perceive others to perceive yourselves. There's, of course, the notion of office politics, like the way just little petty resentments and games and backstabbing characterize office work more than in other workplaces. So all this stuff was he examined, and it remained the only comprehensive book about the topic for years. And people wrote sort of more specialized studies about architecture or about management or what have you, but no one really attempted such a synoptic portrait of white collar work, and that was, you know, now 60 years ago. So I felt like there was a sort of, I mean, I couldn't have hope to compete with his sort of power of analysis, but I thought there was sort of more to say as what's happened in the intervening 50 years.
And like I said, I want to go back through the history of the development of that workspace. But how much through it was this? How much of the development of the workspace through the years was a function of sort of, I guess, of putting white collar workers in an environment where they would be isolated from where they are in the greater sense of labor, I guess?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It's changed over the years. I mean, I think it, but if you look back at the earliest white collar workplaces, or the first moment when people start to call sort of office workplaces offices. I mean, before they were called counting houses, they were called, you know, various things, but the office is a particular place. It does coincide roughly with the separation of white-collar work from blue-collar work. So there was always this sense that office work, since its origins in the antebellum era, was supposed to be different. It was supposed to be elevated. It was dignified. It was clean work. It was business. I mean, it was upwardly mobile in a way that blue-collar work wasn't. And so there was a kind of visual separation in a lot of offices. They would be crowned with sort of Greek Revival architecture. They looked, the workplaces often looked more noble than factory work. And this only increased in the late 19th, early 20th century when business became big business. And it became at once easier to separate offices. I mean, it just technologically easier with telegraph communications, telephones, things like that, the railroad. And then also the office work staff became much more bureaucratized. It became, in its way, it began to resemble factory work more broadly, but was usually separated from it. So a kind of classic instance of this is the Pullman Company in Chicago in the 19th century. You know, Pullman famously was one of the first company towns in the United States, the factory workers who ran the Pullman cars on trains, and they had a huge strike in the 19th century. But actually, the office staff was not participant in this. They had this separate kind of company town in a skyscraper in Chicago, which was really cushy. It had all sorts of amenities, the kinds of amenities we associate with places like Google and places like that now. And that separation, you know, was often enforced in cities. I mean, factories would be in Chicago again, we're sort of on the periphery of the city, and the white-collar offices downtown. And a lot of that was to ensure that white-collar workers were not contaminated with the kind of labor menace that was taking factories. I mean, it's important to point out that it wasn't just that there was a kind of conspiracy to do this. White-collar workers often accepted or consented to this arrangement. They did, in their own terms, express the notion that their work was meant to be kind of middle class. And so that was often the case. So it wasn't just a kind of the hegemony of the management. The two groups work together.
Yeah, and I want to talk about, you know, when we get up to 1950, you know, how much sort of Taft-Hartley had to do with sort of creating that us and them type of dynamic. But let's go back to where where we track the beginning of the origins of the office. Is it around Pullman? And what happens from there?
Oh yeah, so around that time you have Chicago is a good example. Pullman's just a kind of specific example, but a lot of those companies separate their office work staff from their blue collar staff. And then in turn, you know, over the early 20th century, you have the rise of scientific management. Frederick Taylor in particular, who is chiefly remembered for his work on the shop floor and his, you know, his attempts to monitor and motion study workers and find the one best way to have the most efficient standardized work staff. But then they also turn what that has two effects. One is to increase the management hierarchy, so you actually load up the number of workers who are kind of monitoring and surveilling the workers in the factories, and then in turn these workers become subject to surveillance. So you have these very comic attempts to motion study envelope licking, to motion study the fastest way to file, things like that, and the office becomes regimented and more organized along the lines of factory labor. So that's sort of where things start to turn in the early 20th century, and there's pushback against this, especially in the 1930s, when the kind of plausibility of upward mobility in the office is seriously compromised. And so you have a lot more office worker organizing. On the left, you have the left, which was actually for a while sort of just content to think of office workers as plagued by false consciousness. They start to realize that office workers can really be organized. There is a graphic novel that comes out in the 40s called White Collar, about how white collar workers are learning to march alongside their blue collar brethren. So it becomes this big united front of office workers, or at least that's the dream. And some of it actually comes true, and that sort of takes you up to the post-war era, when labor successes become challenged, I guess, by Taft Hartley.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit more about Taylor. I mean, how much of his push for efficiency, how much did it take into account sort of, you know, what could be problematic when worker A starts talking to worker B about what's going on here?
Well, Taylor did have a very anti-union bias. I mean, it was meant to isolate and individualize workers and make them more competitive with each other. The introduction of the piece rate system, where you would be, and the notion that you would really be paid, you would be competing with other workers for higher pay rather than being offered the same salary, that was meant to break any nascent notion of solidarity. It was meant to make workers, think of themselves as individuals and meritocrats in a way, and responsible for their own rise. So that was the attempt that was the ideology behind it. And his acolytes who worked in the office workplace felt that the office was even more susceptible to this kind of appeal, that the office was the height of American individualism, that people really thought of themselves as responsible for themselves in some ways, and not prone to organizing or banding together. So there was certainly a lot of that in the Taylorist ideal, the notion that management had the best way to teach you how to rise up. I mean, people did resist that. Taylor was not very acute in his psychological reasoning, and so there were attempts to moderate it, to make it more, the introductions of Freudianism into the workplace, to make workers feel more at home, to feel that their workplaces were familial. That ends up happening later, but the basic gist stayed the same: the notion that workers were alone and responsible for themselves.
And let's talk about at what point that women are brought into the office. There was one fact that you had talked about, that there was actually like a ceiling placed on what women could earn at that time.
Yeah, which was, in fact, I mean, that was just taken for granted, the notion that women were not, it was not even plausible to, and this of course remained true for generations, but it was not even plausible that women would earn as much as men. And in a way, this eased the notion that they could be slotted into the most menial occupations. I mean, women, when they entered the office workplace, were usually given the jobs in the typing pool. They were stenographers, the kind of lightly mechanical, monotonous, more factory-like jobs. The exception to that was the position of secretary. So there was this kind of division in between, even among women, between the prestigious and less prestigious occupations. Because if you were a secretary, you had a kind of personal relationship to invariably a male boss, and if you derived some prestige from working for a specially powerful or rich boss, people often referred to secretaries as office wives because they saw their bosses more than their bosses' wives saw them, and they were expected to, as well known in popular culture, they were expected to handle their dry cleaning, just be their unofficial therapist, and without any sort of conception of sexual harassment or any of those laws for many years, that was something that women were just expected to deal with, to kind of fend off, at the same time that they had no recourse when it came to a boss who kept making overtures of that kind. So that was the sort of position that women held, at the same time that none of these occupations were ever going to pay very well. Women at some point were expected to get married and leave the office workplace. And even when they did get married, sometimes they were fired as a result. I mean, just there was no notion that they would continue to work after they had been married.
And then talk a little bit about the change to architecture. You mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright's building in Buffalo. I guess in the first couple of years of the 20th century, what was that an attempt to do, and what did it end up doing?
Oh, yeah, so Wright's building, the Larkin Building, in Buffalo, was an attempt in some ways to harmonize all the kind of conflicting impulses of the workplace at that time. I mean, one was that efficiency and factory-like, the smooth factory-like flow of paperwork was essential to office work. The Larkin Company was a mail-order company. I mean, I guess if we were looking for a contemporary example, it would be Amazon. I mean, they because initially they sold soap products, but then over time they just sold anything that could be packaged, just as Amazon initially sold books and has moved on. But they had a lot of paperwork to process, a lot of phone calls, a lot of orders, and so it was a very tough operation to manage. The other thing that they had to manage was the fact that there was a kind of notion that workers still needed welfare, they still needed play, they couldn't do this all the time. They had to feel that their company cared for them. So the Larkin Building had both impulses in play. I mean, one, Wright designed this very, this building that had this very smooth flow of paperwork that actually, if you look at the plans, flows in a kind of spiral downwards, where the orders get received up top and then eventually get processed. And it looks a lot like the Guggenheim Building in New York. So it was a really complex and impressive system of work. At the same time, that he wanted the workers to feel ennobled by the workspace. So there was a central light court that was five stories tall that is really quite, I mean, genuinely beautiful. In photographs, the building is demolished, so we don't see it anymore. But that was meant to, and it had slogans on the wall of it instructing workers that their work was ennobling, that the spirit of self-sacrifice was important for work, and so that was part of its atmosphere. It had a kind of rudimentary form of air conditioning, well before the air conditioning that we know came into being. It was just the air, because Buffalo was largely a smokestack town, and it wanted to keep the workers inside, you know, cool and also the air healthy. So that was part of it. And then it had just, there were company picnics. There was the whole notion of it being a family was part of the atmosphere. The idea being that workers were supposed to really identify with their company and not really feel badly about it. And that's ethos of a company that works you really hard, but then takes care of you, has been a constant in so-called progressive companies over the 20th century.
I mean, that feels like that lasted through, I guess, maybe through the 60s and the 70s to a certain extent. Like, this is going to be my adult life. This is my new family. I mean, you also mentioned, too, that that building was designed to be for easy sort of surveillance on the workers, I guess, as they look down upon them. But let's jump back up to the 50s. I mean, did that distinction between those who were sort of, I guess, considered managers as opposed to those who worked, did that have any implications for the office when via Taft-Hartley, or was that Taft-Hartley was sort of a result of that culture already sort of having been groomed, I guess?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's an interesting question, and actually there's no – this is a topic of some – it's not worth – of some debate, but it is – I think the Taft-Hartley did put the seal on the notion that on a long attempt to figure out – to distinguish between the employee and the worker and the manager. There's some scholarship on this. But it did divide the people who were subject to organization and the people who weren't. I think it was a kind of process. It didn't establish a totally new paradigm, but it did kind of seal the lid on for a while on the notion that salaried employees or whatever were of common cause with blue collar workers. I mean you've seen one sees this even as recently as the UAW vote in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where salaried employees actually could campaign against the union, the blue collar union. So there was that divide that it's just been ongoing. The kind of exception to all this was the public sector, where white collar workers were allowed to organize and did in fact organize en masse. So Taft-Hartley had an effect, and a kind of chilling effect, but I don't think it was the central. It was a kind of culmination of decades of thinking on the topic.
And then the next big, I guess, advance or attempted advance in the workspace comes with the Action Office. Tell us what that attempt was.
So the Action Office was, it came out in, so there were two attempts, but the relevant one came out in the 1960s, late 1960s, and it was, if it was an attempt to give workers in the center of an office basically some semblance of privacy. It was a sort of three-walled, hinged, flexible space invented by this designer working for Herman Miller named Robert Probst. And, you have to think about the context in which it appeared in the up until the 1960s, most offices looked like, if you've seen Mad Men or if you've seen the film The Apartment, there's a center typing pool of desks that's just arranged in rows because it was assumed to be kind of factory-like work. And then offices around the corridor for middle and managers and executives and then more executives on upper floors. Those were arranged by, they had certain status privileges. Like you might have an oak desk if you were a middle manager, a larger office and a mahogany desk if you were an upper level manager, etc. And Probst thought, inspired by other kinds of, at the time, somewhat progressive anthropology and psychology, thought people just needed space that was more suited to work. It was more suited to what they needed to do rather than, what kind of privilege they had earned on the company ladder. And so the Action Office was this kind of semi-autonomous, semi-private space that was meant for this particular kind of worker whom at the time, and this was a new term he called knowledge workers. And it was a really big hit when it came out in 1968. No one had ever seen anything like this. It just, people thought it was a really new conception of what office work could look like. And people began to copy it, a lot of the major furniture companies, and they would install lots of them. And, a lot of the kind of progressive thinking or supposedly progressive thinking that Probst had invested his design with slowly started to seep out of the plans. I mean, you have designers installing hacks of these action office like systems, and they come out and they look like these tall boxes. And it was at and then they realized, you know, it was at this time that the action office acquired the name that it's had ever since, which is the cubicle. And it became this kind of Frankenstein monster that just took over the office, just sort of infinitely replicable, colorless, gray, arbitrary, callous environment that took over the office. And in a way, it wasn't just that the design was bad that made it so loathed in the minds of American workers, but the fact that it took over precisely at the time that the whole notion of one's career and what work should be changed in the 1980s. You know, I mean, the deregulation, the kind of introduction of layoffs and mass layoffs, all of these things came about at the same time that the cubicle was taking over. So the cubicle became this symbol of a kind of callous, transfigured workplace of the kind of Reagan era or the early 1990s, the era of just constant recessions and layoffs and things like that.
What I thought was interesting is that Probst had designed it to be not at 90 degree angles, right? He had designed it to be at 120 degree angles, so they would sort of flare.
Yeah,
out.
Yeah, he had. That's right. Yeah, well, because he thought that workers in general were just going to have the capacity to rearrange what they were doing themselves, and it was meant to be more open. You look at pictures of it, and it seems like it's meant to be this really dynamic, flexible space. It's not the image we have of being stuck at a computer in a box and just being chained to it. I mean, Probst did kind of fall victim to the personal computer that had not existed. He assumed that he meant action in Action Office. Like, it really meant he had images of people standing a lot and walking around. I mean, it was just a much more fluid thing, but it just was much cheaper and quicker to turn it into the box that we know.
And so after we have this sort of new phenomena in the 80s where people realize, like, I'm not going to be at this company for, 20 or 30 years. I'm not going to be a company man. What starts to happen in the 90s and how much was that, did that play out in the sort of the design of the office, this notion of, like, I'm no longer an IBM guy.
Yeah, I mean that was that sort of change in one's relationship to one's company. I think really became most apparent in Silicon Valley in the late 1990s in the first dot-com bubble. You have a lot of employees who come out of places like Intel or IBM or Microsoft, and these are companies. I mean, Intel was actually the first to introduce a kind of all cubicle, open plan office where even the CEO sat in a cubicle, and that was at the time considered very egalitarian. All these companies were seen as innovative or new in that regard. But by the 90s, they thought the workers coming out of these places just thought that they were just empty, silly environments, and that these companies were also bureaucratic and monopolistic, etc. So once the kind of startup craze of that era started, a lot of the kind of dot-comers had a real interest in design. And so, but they needed designs that were much more flexible, much more, you know, that could accommodate a company that had 20 people one day and then 60 people the next because they had this new influx of venture capital. And so you have a lot of offices that, you know, reflect this kind of informality and speed, and that's where a lot of at the same time that they're also working insane hours because the pressure is enormous to make money and to sell their company to Microsoft or whatever their plan is, and so you have, you know, you have the, that's a lot of the kind of cult of informality, the foosball tables, the rec rooms, the lounge chairs. In a way, the office was designed to accommodate these bursts of frenetic activity, punctuated also by bursts of just frenetic gaming or frenetic just play, and for 16 hours a day. And the most famous example of this was maybe the nomadic office of Chiat Day, which was actually an ad firm in L.A. in the 90s, where the idea was that one no longer needed a desk of one's own because you had mobile technology, so you would just be given a computer, a laptop, given a mobile phone, and then asked to find a desk. And this was one of the first experiments of its kind. It failed pretty spectacularly because it was really imposed on the workers. They had no real say in it. But these were the kinds of experiments that took place in the 90s, and I think they really were reactions to the stable, career-oriented workplaces that a lot of these dot-com people had come out of.
I mean, on some level, it seems like it was just it has succeeded insofar as we now sort of seems to live in an age where we never really leave work. I mean, in some places, it's literal insofar as like you don't need to go out to a bar to play pool. We got the pool downstairs. We got the pool table downstairs. There's no reason for you to really leave here. And then you can come back after an hour, and we could spread out your workday over the course of 18 hours. And it's the same dynamic on some level, like with smartphone technology.
Yeah, I mean it's true. A lot of the kind of informality has bled out of the, has meant that the workplace work isn't confined to the office building. And so, you know, it's. On the other hand, the kind of correlate to this is this the fact that the seeming air is just general informality, the fact that you can kind of work anywhere or at any time, but that you have this sense of surveillance and discipline that you is either literal in the sense that someone is actually watching, can watch you through various technologies while you work, or you just have internalized a sense of always being need to be on the clock. So in a way, I think people did want to break that down in the 90s. They did actually feel that that was somehow liberatory, to break down the 9-to-5 day and to blend leisure and work more seamlessly. But, I mean, enough people now know from their own work lives that this is a very kind of busy, frenetic, exhausting way to live. So it's the kind of the cost of the liberation has been high.
Yeah, I mean, like where, you know, because you write about the idea of sort of so many people have become freelancers now, and there's obviously different trade-offs involved in that. But if you were to write a couple more chapters, I guess 10, 15 years from now, would it be the story of how sort of we are cubed less physically and more, I guess, just sort of psychologically?
Existentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's always the office design world is full of futurologists telling us what, you know, is going to happen in the future. So I'm always hesitant to make those claims. But that seems like the safest prediction to make, the notion that the office is really not confined to the office building and that it takes place all over the place. And in a way, we already experience in our own lives that if you live in a city, you see that the cities are gradually trying to support office work no matter where they are. So universities sometimes open up spaces for office workers. Cafes, of course, have become informal offices. There are these, you know, places like co-working facilities where you pay for a desk to have to go to an office. And that corresponds to something else, which is the increasing casualization of labor. So that's, which has been taking a place over generations, but every study seems to confirm that there are more and more freelancers in the economy, more and more people who are independent contractors, people working on informal arrangements or contract arrangements. And those mean that you also are not part of a company with an office, or you have to find your own way to work. So there, those two things are happening. Another way to put that is that it's not just technology; it's the erosion over time of the old way that people used to work, the old sense of the contract between management and labor. So I think that's that's changed a lot as well, the way we work.
And do you think this disempowers, I guess, the worker in this context? I mean, I keep thinking about this story recently. It's not exactly on point, but it reminds me of just recently, you know, there's been an attempt by Uber drivers to organize, but of course they have a tremendous amount of difficulty doing it because they're not in any way tethered to each other. I wonder if this doesn't in some way sort of take it to the next level. There was some measure of isolation within the context of cubicles and some notion of hierarchy that kept people apart. Now it's just sort of literally people are just sort of floating out there in the ether.
Yeah, I mean, it really does feel that way. I think, you know, there's a lot about this freelance economy, or either freelancing side of this economy, or the contract side that makes it much harder to organize. I mean, it at the same time that, you know, a lot of people seek, there is still that content of some sense of autonomy in one's work. When you are a freelancer, at least there's a potential there. At the same time, you're still at the mercy of. It's not like there aren't large companies that are dictating what you do. You're still at the mercy of them. But you know, maybe this is too optimistic. But I do feel that. I mean, there was a period, 100 years ago, when the same discourse prevailed. The sense of atomization, anomy. I mean, the levels of unionization were about as low, and if you think about the conditions that workers faced, including, you know, Pinkertons and things like that, I mean, just like real outright violence, for a while, that struggle seemed to be succeeding. So I think rather than sort of, it probably seems likely that this is the future, the terrain on which people have to organize, the terrain on which people have to seek unions. Rather than, I don't think it's likely that we're going to turn back significantly in terms of how the subcontracting and like not until some kind of way to organize comes about. It's definitely hard, but I don't think it's impossible.
Hope springs eternal. Nicholas Aval, the book is Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. We'll put a link up at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. Remember, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. It's pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen. We need your support to continue this show, provide you great content day in, day out. As a bonus, we give you the another 50 minutes of program. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, fair trade coffee, coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Support the show, get great coffee, support fair trade. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, you might as well buy it from our link at majorityreportkickback.com. When you use that link, you notice no difference, but we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. All right, the number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Opening up a libertarian line today at 646-257-3920 as well. And if you want to IM the show, Majority FM, you can do so through our app at majorityapp.com. What else we got? That's it. We'll see you on the flip side. What's that? Oh, give us an iTunes review. Apparently, the podcast awards, which have traditionally been this time of year, have now been pushed. So they're going to be announced in April, so the nomination has not started yet. Apparently, they've been sold. Not sure to whom, but
I think they were sold to that conference that would host the awards.
There you go. So it's going to be a bigger deal this year, theoretically. But we're not calling on on those votes yet. There's going to be big challenges to us. We got a target on our back, folks.
What happens when you're the 3-year straight winner of Best in News and Politics?
We're trying to bring truth to 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue.
I think we've succeeded. I don't think it was that hard to begin with, to be honest.
What was it that you said? If or to how they dropped the race card?
It was if for what selfish wants.
Who could argue with that? She's right.
If for what, Sam? If for what?
When you're right, you're right.
That's right. You just can't argue. It just drops that many prepositions at one time. It's virtually impossible to argue.
It actually literally cannot be argued. It's absolutely true.
Bill O'Reilly had dinner with Henry Kissinger. Poor Henry Kissinger. Poor Henry Kissinger. That's what he's left to.
Is this really what I've been reduced to?
Only Bill O'Reilly will eat with me.
Had a great discussion with Charlie Rose, but he's not over my apartment.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back after this.